Our journey in the book of the beginnings, the book of Genesis, is coming to an end today. And I know we could have spent many more weeks on this book. There's so much in it, there's so many stories that are worth reflecting upon, but again, we have only that much time. And then Advent is coming, and so we need to prepare for Advent. So next Sunday, as we know, is the first of Advent. So it's a story of beginning, and it's in our context, as we have looked at the story, it is a story actually told by the Jewish people, the Israelites, to recall their history. From Adam to Seth and to Noah to Abraham to Isaac and then finally to Jacob. It is a story, as we have understood and come to see, of sibling rivalry, of intrigue, of favoritism, dysfunction, and sin. It's a story of struggle, a struggle with God, and struggle with one another. It is a story of Israel's faith in God, but it's also a story of God coming through for his people, no matter what. It's a story of God sticking to his long-term plan and commitments. And the one thing that I hope we have learned through this is that reading the book of Genesis, but also I would expand that as say reading the Bible, is a lifelong process of learning. It is a lifelong process of adjustment. A lifelong process of refinement. Because, at least I hope, that in our reading of the Bible and walking our life with God, that we are growing and that we receive new insights and that some of the things that are unclear at some point of time become more clear. So our reading of the Bible is also evolving. And I hope these past weeks that we journeyed into the book of Genesis has helped in this process to maybe reread these stories and maybe get a new perspective on them. And as I've mentioned several times, to get past those curated versions of Sunday school talk teachings and read the stories with our own eyes in the book of Genesis. This whole book now ends with a people in transition to become a nation. As I said, starts with one person, Adam, goes all the way to Abraham, and then we're at the tail end of this where this family has grown. It has become a people, and eventually it will become a nation. It will be continued in the book of Exodus, which is following. This story then also continues throughout the Old Testament, that the story that becomes a nation will end up in captivity in Babylonia and comes eventually, at least part of it comes out of it, and they will recall their whole history again in the light of all that happened. And even if it's getting old, and I repeat myself many times, it's maybe also due to my own age, so it is something that they have told and retold because there were no other ways of capturing history. It was by and large in memory. Very few things were written down, if at all. So this was basically a whole story retold over and over. Somebody had a good illustration for that. It's like a movie based on facts. You know, when you know a movie based on facts, you know, when there are some factual things, but the movie is made around of that and fills in some of the gaps of the facts, because that's the similar thing with the book of Genesis and the other books. There is a book based on facts, but over years and years and hundreds of years of telling and retelling the story, things have been filled into the blanks. So at the end of the book, we meet Joseph, one of Jacob's sons. And with him, we want to close our time that we spent in this book together. And I will read again a short portion out of his story that summarizes more or less what happened to him, and we will expand on that a little more. It's coming from Genesis 50, verse 15 to 21. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge and wants to repay us in full for all the harm that we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph, saying, "Your father gave us these instructions before he died. Tell Joseph this: please forgive the sins of your brothers and the wrong that they did when they treated you so badly. Now please forgive the sin of your servants of the gods of your father." When this message was reported to him, Joseph wept. Then his brothers also came and threw themselves before him and said, "Here we are your slaves." But Joseph answered them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant to harm me, but God intended it for good purpose, so he could preserve the lives of many people, as you can see today. So now, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your little children." Then he consoled them and spoke kindly to them. So if you're not acquainted with the story of Joseph, this little passage already will pique your interest, because there's so many things already mentioned that we would like to know what has gone on here. You know, why are the brothers so concerned about Joseph and that he is still holds a grudge with them? And what about the whole family and the whole family dynamic? So let's unpack a little bit of that and then learn something out of that with our topic that we have today, that God squeezes good out of evil. First of all, there is a world of evil, and that doesn't come as a surprise to you. As you read the story of Genesis, there's a lot of evil and bad things happen. So with this story, the only thing that surprises me when I read the book of Genesis is how raw they have left it, whoever wrote this. There is no editing, you know. It's unlike any other biography that we read. And I read a lot of them, but usually all biographies are edited. And especially if you have biographies of some spiritual people, man, they are just heroes. You know, those people, men and women, they just shine brightly because how they are and who they and how they prayed. And please don't get me wrong, there are giants, and I believe that, giants of faith. But here in the Bible, they don't even make even an attempt to cut that out. They just leave it in. There's a whole bunch of things in it that we feel like, whoa, 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 this is an interesting thing. So here we have the story with Joseph, which also is a story with no exception. Joseph is the favorite son of Jacob, his father. Jacob favored one of his wives. He had two, and then some concubines, but he had two, and he favored Rachel. And Joseph happened to be the son of Rachel. And it was very clear. It's not just that you try as a parent, you know, to be somehow not influenced by that and to show equal love to each one. In the story, it's blatantly told. He favored Joseph. And he proved it that he also gave him a special coat that was colored and that seemed to be a very important coat in those days, so that the other 10 sons could look at Joseph all the time and had it right in front of them. Well, here's the favorite one. Here's the one that daddy likes. So he was spoiled. Spoiled, rotten. And by the way, kids have no fault in that. It's the parents who do that. And kids bear the brunt of it, and those who have to deal with the kids. But he is obviously the fault of Jacob's actions. And if you are aware of all this story, where did it all start? Well, how about Jacob and Esau? How about their family? And how about favoritism in their family, when Jacob was loved by the mother and by his mother, and Esau was loved by the father? And man, talk about family dysfunction. You know what comforts me? You and my family doesn't have to be perfect. Isn't that wonderful? If we are imperfect, dysfunctional to some degree, welcome to the club. We belong to the Bible. It's a whole story full of that. Now, Israel, or Jacob, loved Joseph more than all these. It says here in this text. because he was a son born to him late in life, and he made a special tunic for him. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, what did they do? They hated Joseph and were not able to speak to him kindly. Again, that Joseph now becomes a spoiled brat, that's not his fault, but he also made sure that he played his cards pretty well. Because it says later on, well, first of all, it says at the beginning that he started tattling on his brothers. Well, that is also a reason why you're not really a favorite in your siblings. You know, you're the one who tatters. He's the young one and say, hey, daddy, did you know? You know, so he tatters. It says so, chapter 37, verse 2. Then comes something that even makes it worse. Jacob has dreams. He has dreams. And in these dreams, there is an appearing theme that he will be the big one. And that all his brothers and his father will bow before him. Now, how does that go over? And he also makes sure that everybody knows of the dreams. You know, that they all know, well, you know what, they'll tell you. You know, I'm the one, actually. I'm the chosen one by God. This is right. Enough that Jacob chose you over all of us, and our God as well. So there's the whole story unfolding between 10 angry brothers against a cocky teenager. That doesn't go well. And what happens is, they, at least the brothers, would try to bring it all to an end. They need to kill him. Well, it was those days when you just get rid of a problem by just killing somebody. And that's, it's their plan. So they meet him somewhere outside in the field at some point of time when he was looking, when Joseph was looking for them, sent by his father. So they find him, and then they're set to kill him. They take the tear of his clothes, they dunk his clothes in animal blood, send it back to the father and say, hey, unfortunately, your youngest son was killed by an animal. Sorry. So they tried to kill him too, unless there was the older brother, it's typical, the oldest, you know, who cares for the family, who prevents the whole plan and just finds another way of dealing with the problem and sells Joseph for cash to the Ishmaelites, a trading group. You know, that comes by, and a caravan that comes by, goes to Egypt, and he sells them. At least we make some cash, you know, on our youngest brother. Not a bad deal. So Joseph is sold for cash, and then one more time. So those people, the traders, take him and sell him to one of the highest or high-ranking official on Pharaoh's court. But it seems to be in this context, as we hear the story, that Jacob, that Joseph was not just a spoiled brat. He seemed to have skills. He seemed to be a hard worker. Because he proved himself pretty quickly in this, with the slaves that he was part of, to be one of them who stood out, who had organizational skills, who was a leader. And Potiphar, the name of this guy who owned him, made him the leader of his own. He became the general manager. He's the general manager of the whole household. Everything is run by Joseph. So he comes to a role of a higher position, and he seems to have had a good life. However, trouble is not far away. Potiphar's wife likes him. It says actually in the Bible, it's very interesting, you know, that he was handsome and well-built. Interesting that the Bible has those things in there, you know, he's well-built, handsome guy. So she likes him, and she wants to seduce him. And it seems to be from the story that goes on for quite a while, that she finds any way to just seduce him, you know, and sleep with him. I mean, talk about movies. That's the stuff of movies. So he tries, and Joseph stands his ground. He is not giving in. Now, there is an occasion then when they all both are alone in the house. Bad thing anyhow, so they're alone in the house. And she tries again, and he runs away. And as he does, she grabs his coat, and he just leaves it there and runs out. So if you don't even know the story, you know what happens. She uses that against him. She has his coat. What is the story? Well, he tried to seduce me. You know, and here's my coat. Here's his coat. I can prove it to you. And that's the story that she tells her husband. Well, it brings Joseph. So it's the word of the wife of his owner against the word of a slave. Guess who draws the shorter stick? It's Joseph. He's being thrown in prison unjustly. No fair trial. He is a slave. So there he is in prison. However, in prison again. It shows that he seems to have good skills, organizational skills, leadership skills. He is put in charge of the whole group there. And he climbs through the ranks again to be the top guy who takes care of the other prisoners. And in this story, then, there is something happening that changes the course of his life. Joseph is also then known for somebody who is able to interpret dreams. So two of his prison inmates, one is a cupbearer of Pharaoh and the other one is a baker, both had weird dreams while in prison. The one, the cupbearer's dream, eventually leads to the fact that he dreams about his release, that he will be released. The baker's dream is not so good. He dreams about the fact that he will die. And Joseph tells him as much. The cupbearer is certainly impressed. You know, well, he gets free. He gets the good end of all the story. And he said, well, I'll remember you. You know, when I'm out of prison, I will remember you. And that will be good. But it never happened for several years. But later on, several years later, Joseph is called on to interpret other dreams. Weird dreams, nightmares, I would say, of Pharaoh. Pharaoh dreams that there were seven cows who were fat, followed by seven cows who were very thin and malnourished, and those unnourished cows ate the big ones without, you know, gaining any weight. And the same was true with stalks of wheat. You know that there were some fat stalks of wheat and there were some meager ones that were burnt. So they burnt ones, eat the big ones. And Pharaoh cannot make any sense of that. So what is that? So, and he is eventually called into the court of Pharaoh. But before we go there and look at that, I just want us to stop a moment and think about, wow, what a story. You know, what a story. So here he is played, well, he was a brat, he was spoiled, but his brothers hate him so much, he is being killed, or they want to kill him. But instead of killing him, he ends up to be a slave. I mean, would you have a grudge against your brothers if they would do that to you in spite of what all happened and went down? Wouldn't you? I would. And then he is there in Egypt, and he starts his career. He is as a slave, works as a slave. He makes his way up. He gains the trust. And then he's played again, a bad card. And again, innocently being thrown to prison. I mean, would you feel like, I mean, come on now. You know, what else needs to happen? Has life been dealt those cards to you? Have you been there where you felt like, you know, come on, you know, once is almost enough, but it always comes in pairs and sometimes in three, you know, who knows? But sometimes you feel like that life, you never recoup, you never really get out of it. It's just like bad things come and happen all the time and nothing can be done about it. And the interesting thing, bad comes to me no matter whether I'm a Christian or not or whether I pray or not. Yes, let's face the facts. Bad things happen, whether I pray or not. And I'm living in this bubble sometimes and think like, well, as a follower of Jesus Christ, I should be protected all the time because I prayed this morning. And then this thing doesn't happen, so what then? Does it raise questions in you? Have you ever had those questions? Or there are several other things we just have heard and are hearing this in the news. Maybe you could potentially be one of those victims of the disaster there of mudslides and flooding. And you lose your house and all your possessions. Maybe even someone's life. I didn't hear that the mudslides went around the homes of Christians. They were affected. They experienced bad things. Why? There is crime that followers of Jesus Christ are exposed to. Burglary. Have you had your house or car broken into? I had, at least my car, several times. Have you heard of theft or people who were murdered? Or raped, who were Christians. Bad things happen. And here we have one story in the Bible where that is so evident that bad things happen. And there is not enough explanation to get us a satisfying answer. Bad things happen. We cannot escape the web of evil that we live in, that we are part of in our society, simply because we live where we live. It happens. We cannot run away from this. These things are happening. And again, it's often sometimes that we discuss far away, but when it knocks at my door, it's a whole different ballgame. How we then deal with that. Evil that happens to us demands answers. And that's what our natural go-to is, that when things are happening that we cannot explain, when stuff happens in my life, we demand answers. It may even leave us disillusioned, and for some, turning away from God. Well, as Joseph's story unfolds, he gets out of prison because he interprets the dream of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh also actually gives him a once-in-a-lifetime chance. I mean, he's a slave. Come on. He's a prisoner. But he happens to interpret or make sense of the dreams that the Pharaoh has. And Joseph at least seemed to have changed to such an extent that he doesn't take credit for that. He points to God and says, God is the one who gives me that. There might have been already a change in his life. But then he gets a once-in-a-lifetime chance. And that is that Pharaoh, instead of going to all his advisors, says, hey, do you have an idea what to do with that now? He asks a prisoner to solve a nationwide problem, which is that there will be famine coming so bad that there will be desperate. There's 7 years. And he says to Joseph, hey, do you have an idea what to do with that? And that's the one-time chance that changes the life of Joseph and of hundreds of people and that of his family. And sometimes we miss those points, that some little tiny things when just the Pharaoh turns to him and says, hey, do you have an idea? That those things have far-reaching consequences. And Joseph, smart as he is, and it shows that he was smart enough in his lifetime to learn what it means to organize stuff. And he gives him an idea. He said, hey, why don't we collect all the stuff, you know, during the good times, put it in big barns and big shelters, and then when the bad times come, we have enough to provide for all of us. Man, smart idea, good stuff. He has organizational skills. And the Pharaoh is impressed. He puts him in charge. He becomes second man right beside Pharaoh and is now in charge of the food distribution and collection and food distribution of an entire country. And then the thing happens. His family will be affected by the famine. And his family is now on the search for food, and they send the delegation up to Egypt. And guess what? His brothers run into Joseph. They don't recognize Joseph because he has now Egyptian features. You know, he dresses Egyptian. And Joseph recognizes them. And I can only imagine what's going on in Joseph's mind. Sweet revenge. And some of it happens. Instead of right away saying, oh, wow, good to see you. You know, I've been long to see you. No. He plays the game. Sweet revenge. And you can read it out, but I want to tell the whole story. But he puts them, first of all, he's very harsh on them. Unusually harsh on those people. Accuses them as spies. And you know, and lets them finally bring the one second beloved son of his father, which is his natural brother, Benjamin, and say, let's bring him up. And they say, no, our father will die if you do this. And they have negotiated with him, and he is brutal. Nope, you don't get any more food if you don't bring him. Eventually, we know the story unfolds, and they bring him because famine is too strong, and they bring him, and he plays this game until he finally breaks down and gives himself and let them recognize him. Wow, that must have been sweet. At least some payback. Wouldn't we do the same, you know, if we have the chance? That is just in us, you know, just to give a little bit back. If we play badly by somebody and unfairly, that we put it back. But we also know that if we do that, it sets in motion a cycle of revenge. It is not a solution. Paying back is never good. Paying back is never really a solution to the problem. Because we know the cycle that sometimes can be. If I pay back more than I received, then there's something owed. So the whole cycle goes back and forth. It is not really helping. And therefore, he interrupts the cycle of evil. And the cycle of evil can only be interrupted by forgiveness. Eventually, Joseph forgives his brothers. He doesn't hold a grudge, as it says, as it's indicated in the whole story. There's twice that it is highlighted how genuine he forgives his brothers. First, in his first initial revelation of who he is, in chapter 45, he says this: God sent me ahead of you to preserve you on the earth and to save your lives by great deliverance. So now it is not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me an advisor to Pharaoh, lord over all his household, ruler over all the lands of Egypt. Joseph learned to sort out his life from a different perspective. Instead of holding grudges, instead of looking at his life as bad, you know, sequence of events and bad things that happened to him and holding endless grudges, he came to look at life from a different perspective. And he could say to his brothers with honesty and sincerity, I believe that God was in it and that there was some purpose in my life to be sold as a slave and to end up here. Later on in the text that we just read as a scripture for this morning, he said the same thing. You know, he said, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant harm me, but God intended it for good purpose, so he could preserve the lives of many people as you see to this day. And he could freely forgive them because he saw a different perspective. That he saw in all the evil that others did to him, that God was in it. And that God squeezed good out of this. However, forgiveness needs to be practiced in both ways. Forgiveness needs to be practiced in terms of the one who extends forgiveness to say, well, I truly mean it. It's not just pro forma, I truly mean it. You are forgiven. I hold no grudges. But it also needs to be accepted, and that's what the brothers had issues with. They couldn't accept it. They couldn't believe it. They came up with this ruse where we don't know that it really happened, but they said, hey, your father said something, you know, to forgive us. We don't have no record that it ever happened, but why not bring up the father and make him, you know, sure that he will forgive them and not hold grudges against them? They had to learn to accept forgiveness, which is a matter of trust. To accept it, to say, okay, I have no guilt. He will not get revengeful. This whole story brings us to this question of evil. And I will not answer it this morning. But it begs to be answered, because it is the question that ever so often comes up. And it is one way how this text at least deals with this, how Joseph deals with this, how Joseph deals with all the ill fortune of his life, with all the hurts and the pains that were inflicted on him, all the injustice that he experienced, that he could somehow come to a point where he could see on this in a positive way. And I mentioned here that it's taken from another title that I actually read in a book, God Squeezed Out Good from Evil. Good squeezed from evil. And I think it's a good way of saying this, because many other answers lead to problems. To say it right offhand, I think in the end, there is hardly any fully satisfying answer to that question. Why is there evil? And why does evil hit me? It's not so much I have a philosophical question or a philosophical answer about why is evil in the world. That's one thing. It always becomes much more difficult if that hits my door, if it's I am the one who feels the evil or the bad thing that is happening to me. And especially if it's repetitive, there are several waves of evil coming into my life and I have to find an answer. That is not personal and way more difficult to answer. Joseph evaluates his life again from a different vantage point. He sees God's hand in it. He looks at all that had happened in hindsight and says, God somehow worked it out, squeezed good out of this evil that happened, so that now I can save hundreds of and thousands of people, even the survival of my own generation and my family. However, saying this, we have to be very careful not to say that God orchestrated all that evil, that God orchestrated the famine, that God orchestrated the being sold into slavery. Instead, it is something that God redeemed. The word that is used in many translations here, by the way, intended, is often or can better translate it with use. God used this, made use out of that to what you meant harm to me. God used it to do something good. God hates evil. He is never the originator of evil in any shape or form. And he also does not deliberately use evil as a tool, as punishment or even education. He is not. If you say so, then he is involved in evil. Can't help it. Philosophically, it doesn't make sense. Instead, I would rather see what we see in the Bible all over, proven more than anything. God cries with the victims. He suffers with them. Even saying or believing that God could have prevented this evil, but he didn't, makes God look very brutal. Have you ever thought about that? I know it's said so many times, and believe me, in my own life, through the things that I've gone through, I've thought through this so from so many angles, tried to find answers to the questions that are there. But you see, if I would say God could have prevented the evil, but he didn't, what I say is, let's say there is some child of his, a follower of Jesus, being raped. And God stands there and says, I could prevent that, but I won't. Really? What would you do as a father or mother if your child is being raped and you could do something about this? Tell me. So when you're telling me if what you would do, God wouldn't, God would just, you know, it works out for good eventually. You see what we're saying with that? So that's what I'm saying. This is not easy to answer those questions, but also be careful with those answers that we often give, or those answers that we sometimes throw out there and think, oh, they're so smart, and they're so philosophically great, but they don't make sense, friends. God is not a monster. God is not enjoying evil happening to his people. God is not enjoying evil happening to you if you are one of the victims of evil or anything that happened in your life. God is not. God was not standing by and say, oh, I could have changed it, but, you know. God is not. At least not the God that I read in the Bible or the one who reveals himself in Jesus Christ. And I say it again, we struggle for answers. And they are not easy to come by, and even if we have something that somewhat satisfies us, for me, it's still God manages to squeeze good out of evil. Evil is happening. And God is not managing evil per se. Like, for example, saying God is in control. God knows what he is doing. How many times have I said it and heard it? But I still know when my daughter was killed in an accident, that was not that was not an answer. Oh, God is in control. He knows what he's doing. He needs another angel in heaven. Really? Really? So be careful what we throw out there if you think about the problem of evil and how we explain our lives. Is an escape at best if we use those answers? It doesn't answer agonizing pain, nor is it any comfort. Or somebody say, everything happens for a reason. Really? I know we said it. I said it too sometimes. But truly? Everything happens for a reason. So in other words, God allows all this, and then something, you know, so that he permits the evil for a higher purpose. I read another book recently of a person who was diagnosed with cancer, incurable cancer, where somebody came to this person and said, oh, you know what, heaven is our home. And she answered, so do you want to die before me? Please, if that's so comfortable to you. You see what we do sometimes with those pat answers, that they are hurtful, more hurtful than ever helpful. Or somebody else wrote, you know, those know-it-alls. When I have those pat answers, said, hey, would you write me a note when you face death? I want to see whether you know it all then. All I'm saying is there is no easy answer. There is no quick response that even how theologically this seems and how much we may think this or that might be right. It is not easy to answer. Job, if there's one book in the Bible, teaches us that. That there is no easy answer to the problem of evil because Job suffered evil and God is not answering any of his questions. None. The only thing that happens at the end of the book is that Job, shuts up. and says, I have no answer. I just submit to God. See, this is where we are left when we go through difficult times. And you have been through this. You have been through some of the things in your life, big and small. You know, you suffer sometimes with the illness of your children. You suffer with incurable diseases, chronic diseases, things that you deal with in your own life. And you may have those questions, why me? Why not this other couple there, you know? Why us? Why do some go through life without any hiccups? You know, they have it all good. Have you ever thought that? I do. Ever so often. But it is not always easy to answer. Here in our text, Joseph, throughout his life, and there is years in between that we often miss when we read these stories, came to look at his life and said, God squeezed good out of evil. And that's what God is in the business of, but he never does it single-handedly. Listen carefully. He never does it single-handedly. He uses us in cooperation with us. As we yield to him, as we cooperate with him, he can manage to take out of the worst situations and make something out of that that honors him. He will not prevent the evil from happening. But he will work with us so that love promotes well-being, that love is being extended, that we hold on to him, that we see him crying with us when we cry, that we see him suffer with us when we suffer. And friends, that is why Jesus became man, human being, to be in the midst of our life and you and my life. And he was not taken out of that. He did not create meals because he could snap a finger and poof, there was a meal. No, he had hunger and he stayed away from food. He had sleepless nights. He was attacked. He was insulted. And eventually he was tortured and he was killed. So he experienced the gamut of human experience, and he is now journeying with you through this life. It says in Hebrews in one text that we have a high priest who is not incapable of sympathizing with our weaknesses, but who has been tempted all the way just as we are, yet without sin. Jesus also mentions that at the end of his life, when he talks to his disciples, and he prepares them for the time that he will go up into heaven and he will leave them alone. He leaves them a very crucial message. He says in John 16:33, I have told you these things so that in me you have peace. In the world you have trouble and suffering. Sometimes we don't read that. we read the first, but oh, we have peace and I have overcome the world. But we miss that he is very clear about this. You, in this world, you have trouble. And the word trouble here means it's tlipsis. It's really this pressure. You have pressure in your life. You are squeezed from everything. And you have suffering. You have pain. But take courage. I have conquered the world. There is no promise of health and wealth. There is no promise of bliss in this world. But there is a God who suffers with us. There is a God who journeys with you. And I don't know what your current situation is. What are you struggling with? Again, the spectrum is as big as we are here today and as many people out there. Can you embrace the fact that Jesus is sitting with you there and sheds tears with you? Can you hear him say, I am so sorry that you have to go through this? Can you? Or are you sitting face to face and you say, God, why did you have the letters happen to me? Why did you, you know, let me go through this? Why did I lose my loved one? Why did I lose my job? Why did I lose that? Why is my relationships bad? Why do we deal with chronic disease? And we sit in a courtroom and we battle it out. Or can you sit with him side by side? He puts his arm around you and says, I love you. I love you. I want to help you to get through this. I want to help you to squeeze something good out of this. I want to work with you and with this situation that something good will come out of that. Maybe it is that you become more mature. I will help you with that. Maybe you are able to learn to be a good comforter in a situation that's similar to yours. Maybe I can help you with that. And then we'll find strength in his journey with us. He has conquered the world. In the end, what Jesus is pointing to is death, the ultimate weapon of evil, has been conquered. The ultimate weapon of evil has been conquered. So no matter what happens in our lives, we cannot escape death. It will come somewhere or the other. But Jesus says that enemy is conquered. And he points to the life that starts here and will eventually last forever with him. And maybe then we have some answers, but maybe then we have no questions. We'll just enjoy being around him. Let's pray. Oh God, there are so many questions. There are so many questions, even if we look into our own personal lives. We have looked into Joseph's life today, and there are so many questions. There's so much evil happening today in this world, this very moment. This very moment, children are raped, people are murdered, Christians are persecuted, loved ones die, people lose their jobs, some get the news of incurable disease, some have marital problems, some have broken relationships within their family. Some are losing all their money and security and income. It's all happening at this very moment, somewhere. And we're often shaken when it happens to us, when in some form or the other we are come very close or even are victims of that. God, I grieve for those who are among us here today who have been victims of some of those ugly consequences of evil. I feel sorry for them, sorry for their pain, their tears, their questions. They're seeking for answers. Their journey that may have led to be disillusioned with faith in you. God, will you somehow lay your arms around those and tell them that they're loved? Tell them that you have never left them alone. That somehow, like Joseph, they could say, God, somehow squeezed good out of that evil. But maybe that's not what is at this time the right thing to say. Maybe it's just telling them that you are there. You're journeying with them. You care with them for that child that needs special care. You worry with them about the parents who are aging. You are journeying with them in this difficult job situation. As there are so many things to answer and so many things to do. Father, will you please come and minister to us that we can see that you are God who loves us through. And in the end, let us hold on to the fact that this life will come to an end, and that your promise of the kingdom of God to take hold on this world today and in the future is something that we hold on to very tightly and fast, knowing that you have overcome the world. There is nothing that will stop it from happening. There is no force in heaven and earth that can prevent the kingdom to break through, and we want to be part of that. But in the meantime, as we go through this time of trial and suffering, let us hold on to you and hold on to the truth that you are God who will bring us through this time. We pray this in Jesus' name.